Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Cooking issues!
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live every Tuesday from 12 to 12:45. Actually, we might be able to go to one today.
Yeah.
Ho! Ho! Extended edition Cooking Issues here, live with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez and Jack and Joe in the engineering room. Hi, guys.
Hi.
What's up?
Hi. I had something. I actually headbanged my headphones off during the intro there. Maybe we should tighten up our headphones, huh?
Yeah. Well, speaking of Joel, I kind of wanted to read this email he sent me. He's thrilled we're playing the song. He wants to take us off maybe on that offer and do a live recording. And then he says he's got all these other tracks he wants to give us, including a Harold McGee tribute song.
Whoa.
And other stuff he's written about pigs. He says, I've been writing songs for a long time now. My wife hates them. Let's hope you like it.
I want to hear the Harold McGee.
Can we just like get a copy of the Harold McGee? How fast can we get a copy of the Harold McGee tribute song?
Like right now? You can
like
email
right
it
now.
To me?
Joel, if you're listening, yeah. We need that right now.
Yeah. Joel, if you're out there, let me see you dance. For those of you that listened to the Prince's Black album back in the day. And also apparently we had like some sort of a firebrand performance going on the show prior to this because the mic was totally loose. Like the mic had been like blasted off of its like gimbals here and was like, you know, practically lying on the floor of the studio. It was the gun show.
Yeah.
Apparently a rattling time had at least by the microphone. Is this the microphone they use? This one?
Yeah, one of them.
Yeah. That thing was off its hinges. Anyway, so anything good going on, Stas?
No, not really.
No? Really, literally nothing good is happening.
Nothing good is happening.
Nice. That's well. That makes what we do sound very interesting.
We weren't invited to the Christmas party.
Christmas was a long time ago. You're referring to the Momofuku holiday party.
Yeah, Pepper and I were talking.
I found out where the invitation was.
Well,
you know how whenever they send you your fake paycheck that doesn't have that says this is not a paycheck.
I don't get that anymore.
Because you have someone else throw it away for you.
No, yeah, really, yeah. I don't get. No, no, they asked me. Do you want it sent to you?
No, and that's
I said, no, thank you.
It was on.
Okay, well, it wasn't there.
Because you don't get it. They literally have to. They have to print it. Like by law, it's printed. Like so, someone throws it away for you because you probably said, "Keep it the hell away from me."
No, it's like,
and that's where the holiday party was. That's where the holiday party invite was on the pay stub.
Oh.
So you, in fact, were invited.
Well, I did
so you
ask
can't...
people last night where it was, and no one got back to me or Piper.
I like. Well, Piper didn't want to see you. Piper saw you all day. He didn't want to see you at night.
No. Piper was asking me, "Where is it?"
Yeah, whatever. I did not go because I was sick as a dog last night. I was like, I got like, all of a sudden. You ever have like an instant sore throat?
Mm-hmm.
Like kaboom. I'm on like heavy meds now. I'm on like super heavy meds.
Wow.
Anyways, speaking of heavy meds, we're on track for our Kickstarter. I can't tell you people what it is yet, but I was testing out the thing that we're using at the pizza party I had because every year of my kid's birthday. I have a pizza party at my house where the kids make the pizza, and I was using it. It's not a pizza oven, don't you? But I was using it. We cranked out these freaking kids. We cranked out 20 freaking pizzas in like 2 hours, and they ate every last one. And we didn't have that many people. I don't know where the heck all that pizza went.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Also made some fake Twinkies. Some fake Twinkies. So like you know how the Twinkies hostess is out of business. Right?
Right.
Right. And you know how, not only is she shopping for Zappos, folks, she's playing the music from the website.
Not even Zappos.
First of all,
it was Sirius Radio was on before.
Trader.
Awesome. Listening to a competitor. Trader, yeah. Terrible. Terrible. First of all, anyone out there who designs a website and puts music on it, have your head examined. Do
it's
not
Sirius Radio.
Whatever. Okay.
It's a radio.
Unless you are Sirius Radio or Pandora or Heritage Radio Network.
They have to click for artists to come on. We don't just, you know, autoplay things.
It's because we're not bad people.
Exactly.
We don't like invade your home. It's because you happen to come to our website, you know, perhaps in error. We hope not. We don't invade your home. Anyway, so Host is out of business. I bought a box before Christmas, before holidays, for my kids of Twinkies because they'd never had one. And I grew up with Twinkies. I was like, oh, kids had Twinkies. My wife was like, what the hell are you doing buying my kids Twinkies? And so anyway, they loved it. And all of a sudden, because it's not available anymore, it became their favorite dessert on earth. By Christmas time, they were up to $25 for a box of 10. I think the MSRP on that sucker was like $4.50 or something like that. So I bought two for Christmas, but then I decided I'm going to buy you can buy pans that make Twinkies. They're Twinkie-shaped pans. Everyone on the line, on the internet, they make the fake Twinkies by molding aluminum foil around spice bottles and then using that. But I was like, you know, if my kids want Twinkies, I'll invest the money in the pans. So I got the pans, and I followed Todd Wilbur. You know Todd Wilbur? You're familiar with Todd Wilbur?
Yeah.
Todd Wilbur, he has since I think the 90s or something, the 80s, 90s, has had a bunch of books called Top Secret Recipe.
Mm-hmm.
And in Top Secret Recipe, it's he figures out what's the real herbs and spices? He's not from around here. He doesn't sound like that. He's from New Mexico or some crap. But he's what are the herbs and spices in Kentucky Fried Chicken and stuff like that? So he posts. In fact, he has a recipe I haven't tested it for Heinz ketchup, fake Heinz ketchup, and whatever. Just go buy Heinz. Heinz is a delicious ketchup product. Anyway, unless you don't like Heinz, but I think Heinz is a fine ketchup product. Is that your favorite ketchup, Seth?
I really don't care.
Are you a freak? Are you a freak?
I really don't
How do
care.
You work in the cooking business and
care.
Not care about the ketchup's
care
taste
about,
different?
I don't care. I don't care.
You don't care?
I really don't
so
care.
So I could serve you poop in a bottle
no,
and say, it's ketchup, and as long as it
favorite,
says ketchup on the bottle, you don't care?
What's my favorite ketchup? I don't know. Whatever's on the table. I don't care. I really don't care about that kind of stuff.
What the hell is wrong with you? How could you not care about
it's
it?
It's ketchup.
It's not.
All right.
It's not. They taste different. That's
like
you know what? 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 You know what, Stas? I'll tell you what. I owe Stas. I still owe her a bottle of
That's
good wine
true,
for a
yeah.
bet I've lost. I'm just going to get her anything because what does it matter? It's wine.
No, wine
it's wine.
Fine.
What does it matter? It's wine. Doesn't matter.
Fine.
Doesn't matter what kind of grapes went into it. Doesn't matter how it was made.
On air ketchup tasting.
They're different. They're different.
What about
you, Hunt's
Jack?
Ketchup
what's
and
Jack?
Heinz
what's
ketchup
your, what's
don't
your favorite
taste the same.
Ketchup, Jack.
I like Sir Kensington's.
Wow.
They're friends of the network. No, honestly, I don't know. I mean, usually you get Heinz, right? I mean, I know when I taste something that's not Heinz, and I'm usually kind of disappointed.
Yeah, because Hunt's ketchup, no offense to the
right.
Hunt's Corporation, they make fine canned tomato products, but Hunt's doesn't taste like Heinz does.
It doesn't.
I don't care. The hell is that? You're supposed to care about every aspect
I know.
Of the what
of the world.
Maybe we can do a new show at 1 o'clock called "I Don't Care" with Nastasia.
No, it's just everything.
Yeah.
Where Nastasia tackles the world because she doesn't care. Man, god dang. So, anyways, making the Twinkies, but the problem was the issue is that the kids don't want a good sponge cake filled with some sort of cream filling that dad can come up with. They want freaking Twinkies. So I'm not trying to I wasn't trying to work on that. So I had to use his fake recipe, which is boxed pound cake and whipped egg whites for the and it pretty dang close to a Twinkie actually. You know, Booker was like, real Twinkies, Dad, are slightly better. They're slightly better. Well, I was like, that's perfect. You don't want it to actually be better than the Twinkie. You want it to be just slightly less good so it tastes like you're actually shooting for the Twinkie. Anywho, but the filling was so freaking thick that I followed the recipe. The filling is marshmallow fluff, Crisco, trans-fat-free Crisco, a little bit of powdered sugar and salt with a little bit of water in it. And I guess the water level wasn't enough or whatever. I don't know. It was so freaking thick that both pastry bags that I used exploded. The Hostess brand Twinkie bags, no wonder they went out of business. The bags exploded and sprayed filling all over the table. It's a freaking nightmare. Next time I do it, I'm going to make a thinner Twinkie mix. But now that I own two pans, I guess I'm going to have to make Twinkies all the time.
It's funny how everybody cares about Twinkies so much.
You know why?
Yeah, I know, but
I mean, it's like anything. You don't care about Twinkies?
I don't care about Twinkies.
The hell? You don't care about... What do you care about? Tell me something you care about.
I mean, I mean, I
could name a thing you
I
care
wouldn't
about.
Go above and beyond to make Twinkies because now they're out of business. They never had a place in my life.
Well, I never would have if my kids weren't now obsessed with it. Mm-hmm. And they're obsessed with it because they can't have it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same thing that everyone cares about X, Y, or Z. As soon as it's gone or as soon as somebody's mm-hmm. dead, they care about it a lot more.
That's
right?
True.
So same with Twinkies, especially because my kids now, like, they love any kind of dessert. So they get the Twinkies, and then they're like, oh, my God, I love it, and I can't have it. I need it. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't personally care about Twinkies that much, except for I care about, you know, my kids.
Yes.
And they care about the Twinkies. So you still have not named something you care about. So further proof that Nastasha's next show that she's going to do on her own is just like anything in the world. I don't really care. I don't really care. Our good friend Vidiot wrote in saying he had a cookbook recommendation because we were talking about Indian cookbooks. But he took a very interesting tack. Instead of recommending a book about Indian cooking, he recommended a book that is printed by an Indian person in India about vegetarian cooking, but it's not strictly speaking an Indian cookbook. It's kind of interesting. He says, I'm behind on the schedule podcast, but regarding Indian cookbooks, the unique book of vegetarian cooking by Siraj Joshi is an impressive book. And I don't know if it, and then he added later, I don't know if it's published in the U.S., but her son's a friend and the book is good. She also did an all spinach book called Palak Preparations. I like that, Palak Preparations. Anyway, Sam, it's not available in the U.S., but I did look it up. You can't get it in the U.S., but an interesting take. A non-Indian food, necessarily food. It has like Mexican food, Chinese food, and Indian food anyway. But anyway, I said I would read it on the air, and there you have it. At Clef's write in, what is a good way to keep taro, potatoes, and other starchy foods firm after cooking? Or maybe just firm the surfaces? Well, I mean, the classic way to keep things firm, and this goes back to the first instance I read about this was Jeffrey Steingarten, and I think it was in his original book, The Man Who Ate Everything, which I think I told said on the air. I always keep confusing with the man who mistook his wife for his hat. So, like, the titles
also
of the
be by Jeffrey.
It's not by him. It's by Oliver Sacks. But like, somehow I always confuse the two titles, and so I was like, The Man Who Mistook Everything for His Hat, or Ate Everything with His Hat. Anyway, I always get confused. But The Man Who Ate Everything, which was probably, when I read it, one of the most, and you know, it still is, in other words. But you know, when I read it, especially, was one of the most important food books that I ever read. Really, I mean, really, you know, fantastic book. You know, it's a compilation of all his articles from Vogue, not all of them, but many of them, in which he says that you should care about everything and you should try everything. And he's told you that personally himself. Anyways, so he has a section on potatoes, mashed potatoes in particular, and I think also French fries and whatnot, but mainly mashed potatoes. And it was an extremely influential article on keeping them firm and together by preheating them at a temperature to activate the pectin methylesterase enzymes that are in the potato, and thereby provide structure to it later on in the cook process. Bang. Okay. So that's a long way of saying pectin methylesterase. So here's what's going on. I mean, the problem with starch is that starch swells, it's going to burst and leak out, right? But you can harden it somewhat and protect it somewhat by strengthening the pectin that's holding the whole thing together, because even though there's a whole boatload of starch in a potato, it still has a lot of pectin there holding things together. Now, pectin, naturally, what happens is it cross-links with calcium to get stronger, right? So you need calcium present. So this is why, like, you know, we use calcium to firm up vegetables, or calcium chloride is used to firm up tomatoes, right? So if you're making canned tomatoes, you add calcium chloride, even though calcium chloride tastes terrible. You add it, and that small amount of calcium allows the pectin to cross-link. When it cross-links, it gets firmer and then doesn't break down when it's cooked. However, you have to use not all the pectin has the ability to cross-link that way. You have got to demethylate it, right? So you got to use a pectin methylesterase, which is an enzyme, which makes the pectin more readily cross-linked by the calcium. So it's a two-part process. You need to activate the enzymes that are in the potato already, usually by heating up, I think it's like somewhere near 60 Celsius or something like this, and then maybe a little higher, 60, 65 Celsius, and you need to have calcium present. Now, there's some calcium present there already, but you can use the enzyme, pectin methylesterase, which you can purchase from Novozymes. I don't know if Modern Harvest pantry stocks it yet. But you can buy that and then add some calcium to it, or you can just use calcium and the natural enzymes that are in there to cross-link it. Yeah?
Good job.
Yeah. I don't care. Okay. Andrew Campbell writes in, Robbie Burns night is fast approaching. Any tips on a more modern preparation of haggis or of cooking organs sous vide? Have we done haggis on this show?
I don't think so.
Haggis.
I have two cans. We should eat it soon.
You haven't eaten one yet?
Mm-mm.
Your sister had it when she was in Scotland, though, right?
Yeah.
And she loved it, right?
I have a Scotch flavored haggis.
Ooh.
Did she like the haggis?
She liked it a lot.
Yeah. You know why? Because haggis is delicious. Haggis, let me just say this. Cooking Issues, the show, is going on record as saying that haggis is freaking delicious product. Yeah. And you don't have very long left. I think Bobby Burns Day is, what, the 25th or something like that? Something. Anyway.
What is that?
You know Bobby Burns, the famous poet from Scotland who wrote such ditties as Auld Lang Syne.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, so like they celebrate his, I guess, his birthday every year in Scotland, and you have haggis and you drink scotch and he has a poem about haggis that you're supposed to read before you eat the haggis. So for those of you that are haggis deficient in your knowledge, I'll give you the here's how they gross you out with haggis, right? This is what they say. It's like the heart and the lungs and all of the goopy crappy stuff inside of a sheep, and it's stuffed into a sheep's stomach and cooked, and then you eat it, right? That doesn't sound so appetizing. No?
Speak for yourself.
Right, but to a lot of people that doesn't sound appetizing. In reality, what it is it's one of any number of dishes that's produced with the pluck. So the pluck is all the stuff in the center of an animal. So typically that would constitute hearts, lungs, liver, kidney, all that stuff. All of the awful meat that's there. Not awful with an A, with an O. And another famous dish like that in the U.S. is scrapple. Right?
Mm-hmm.
A dish that I also think that everyone needs to eat much more often, assuming that they eat meat. Now, all of these awful dishes are meant to use the pluck in a way that, use it. But what they do is you make the stock with it, and then you use the stock to cook a grain. So in the case of haggis, it's oatmeal mixed up with these cooked pieces of meat and the stock that it comes from, stuffed inside of the sheep's stomach, which is the lining, like a pudding case, right? And then cooked, more. So the whole thing slices out like a big, oatmeal meatloaf mush. It's freaking great. It's great. Whereas, scrapple is all of, the pig's parts, like the hearts, lungs, all that. Well, not anymore. But liver chopped up and then made a stock. And then you take and chop up the pieces and you put it into cornmeal, right? Which is, just a better version of polenta. And then when you fry it, it gets the gelatin from the stock melts. This is scrapple. And it gets all gooey and delicious. And it's great. It's fantastic stuff. Now, the trick is people are grossed out by some of these meats. And so, first of all, you can't serve lungs in the U.S. at all. So lungs is traditional part of Scotland. You ever had lungs?
No.
They're good, but they're spongy. I have to be honest, they're spongy. So a typical Italian dish that my stepfather used to love when he was growing up, because his dad was a butcher, and he would bring home the hearts and the lungs, even though he wasn't allowed to sell the lungs because he would slaughter his own sheep, was a mixture of hearts and lungs, from around the Naples version that was, I think, in a tomato sauce. And so he used to love it because the chewy parts of the heart and the spongy parts of the lung. Anyway, you cook them together. But you can't have lung here in the U.S. But the trick to making this thing modern is if someone doesn't necessarily – see, back then you're making it because you wanted to use all those meats. If you don't necessarily want, for instance, the stronger taste of liver in your scrapple or in your haggis, you can just omit it if you want to. You know what I mean? It's not going to be the same. It's not going to be traditional. But this idea of a very flavorful stock made from gelatinous and flavorful meat that you cook in a stock, grind up, and then mix with a grain like oatmeal, and then cook in a pudding way or a loaf, is freaking valid, even if you were to use high-grade stuff. So we made a high-grade haggis at the FCI a number of years ago, where we used meat that you would actually normally just eat, and cooked it along with some offal that we could put in and do it. So there you have it. Now, in terms of cooking in general, low temperature with oh, and if you want to know about Scrapple, you can buy William Moyse Weaver's book, Country Scrapple, which is tedious but exhaustive and like thoroughly researched on Scrapple and its importance in America and in tracing it back to, you know, tracing it back to Germany, Europe, and all of its roots over there. Anyways, it's a Pennsylvania Dutch thing. Dutch meaning Deutsch, not Dutch meaning Dutch from Holland. Anyway, so the trick with in general with modern cooking there is when I was saying modern, I meant modern from a taste perspective. If you want to go modern in terms of cooking low temperature sous vide, you have to remember that you still have to cook the thing at a high enough temperature to cook the oatmeal out. So you're probably not going to do an extremely low temperature cook. Same with Scrapple for polenta. You know, you still need to cook out the polenta, so you need to go to a higher temperature than you normally would. But you could do it in a bag if you wanted to keep all the flavors. And the issue is that a lot of times with offal and with variety meats, if you're using variety meats, a lot of the old style preparation of these meats is to try to get rid of some of the inherent aromas, let's say, that they have, or flavors, and so you'll have recipes where things are soaked in milk beforehand to draw out stuff, or they're parboiled first to draw things out. And if you don't do those sorts of things, I mean, remember that sous vide, if you put something in a vacuum bag, tends to concentrate aromas over time. So if something has an aroma that you're trying to get rid of, or a taste that you're trying to get rid of, you don't want to put it in a bag right away because it's just going to seal the stuff in. The second thing, the reason you'd want to do low temperature sous vide on one of these things is because you want to make it more tender than you otherwise would. But you have to look at how tenderness really works when you're doing low temperature cooking. So let's say you're going to cook a regular piece of muscle meat that has a lot of collagen, right? And you don't want to cook it to a high temperature because you want to not overcook the muscle that's within it to, you know, over medium rare or medium, let's say. So you do low temperature for a long time, and the long, long time breaks down things like skin, things like connective tissue. And this is why this is a good technique for things like pork tails that have a lot of collagen, a lot that can break down into gelatin over long cooking, right? But and it keeps them whole because it doesn't melt them out. It just converts them to gelatin in their own place without actually melting it out the way you would in a traditional braise. So it's fantastic for things like that. Meats like heart are not tough because they have a lot of collagen. They're tough because the muscle fibers are extremely strong. So cooking at low temperature isn't going to soften it the same way it would soften, let's say, a short rib. What's going to happen with heart is you're actually going to break the muscle fibers down by extreme long cooking, but that's a different kind of tenderness. Now, back when Stas used to pay attention to the sous vide class that we would
talk. I've sat through that like 5 times.
Well, more like once, and the rest typed your way through it. But the but one of the classic things I want people to taste when they're tasting low temperature cooked meats is the difference between tender and mushy, because they often get confused. And when I cook a piece of steak too long, for instance, to me it's no longer tender. When the muscle fibers themselves start breaking down, it becomes mushy. And you've tasted that, right, Stas?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you care about that?
No, of course.
All right. Well. So she's
if
not.
It's mushy,
so she's
tender,
not talking about that on the show. But the the point is that you can tenderize something like a heart, but I think a lot of the tenderizing you have to be careful that it doesn't edge over into the mushy zone. Also, certain things like liver, if they're cooked for a long time in a bag, accentuate the livery flavor. And in fact, cuts of meat like eye of round that. You know, when they're cooked for a long time, also tend to become livery. So I wouldn't cook something that's livery for a very long time in a bag, because if you do, you're going to accentuate that livery note. Anyway, hope that's helpful. Does that seem helpful at all?
Yes.
Yeah. What time is it? I can't even see the clock.
12:25.
So should we go to our first commercial break?
Yes. Yeah.
We're going to our first commercial break. Call in to 718-497-2128. Cooking Issues.
Today's theme song for Cooking Issues is by Joel Gargano. The break song is Fish Is Vodka by The Meatballers. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Oh, yeah! Back with Cooking Issues. What's up, guys?
Nothing like coming back with Dorothy.
Yeah, coming back with Dorothy. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Shout out, Dorothy.
Speaking about coming back, the blog's back on the air. What?
I don't even believe that. Is that true?
It is.
Wow.
We don't get a clap. We don't get a clap for that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, man.
You didn't believe it.
Although, I just got tweeted out this. So what happened is that our good friend Paul Adams decided to take, who you know writes for Popular Science, decided to, and he you know he tasted surströmming with us. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Did we ever talk about that on the air?
In the cab.
What? Oh my God! So well, so surströmming is this like horribly? It's like horribly stinky. Even I had issues with it. It's incredibly stinky fish that is not salted enough to totally kill everything and then ferments inside – it's from Sweden – ferments inside the can. And so like a bulging can is actually the sign of a good surströmming. And you like keep it in this can for a year and you open it and pungent. You were there for that, right?
Yeah.
Did you eat it?
Yeah.
Did you like it?
No.
It's intensely freaking salty and – the smell is beyond what you would think is possible in something that you would put in your mouth. It's like it is like I've never seen flies attracted to something so fast. Remember that? There was like there was no flies anywhere, and all of a sudden like we were swarming, we were like beating the flies away. And only I ate it a couple of times. I you know got it down. We had like the rye bread and we had akavit and all this other stuff. But only Harold McGee, who was like, doesn't have the vomit note that the last one I had. Remember that? Doesn't have the vomit note. That was what his complaint. It was his complaint.
Yes.
That it didn't have the vomit note from the first time or the other two times he had had it. The only other guy who was pounding surströmming was Paul Adams.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that he was like, you're not going to throw that can away, are you? He also doesn't talk like that. He's like, you're not going to throw that can away. He's like, I'm going to take that back to the office. Took it in a cab with him. I am sure that this cabbie, like, if this cabbie had been armed, Paul would have had a problem. You know what I mean? Because this was the stinkiest thing that ever happened. Anyways, so our good buddy Paul, he got the cooking issues back online. We finally got the passwords. We have control. But unfortunately, Nastasha, I don't know if you heard this morning, but someone said that we are reinfected already.
What?
And it's like, you know, you try and do something.
Do you guys use WordPress?
No. I don't know.
But so for those that tweeted that to us, we're getting that worked on, and we're going to Paul said he might actually write some stuff for the cooking issues. We're going to become a viable blog again, people.
Tell me where you see it is infected.
I didn't see it was infected. No. Someone else did.
Well,
you have to go to my Twitter account. She's like, I can't be bothered.
I just have one thing for Joel Gargano. If he's going to do a Harold McGee kind of tribute band, that maybe he might want to call it Vomit Note.
Ooh.
Whoa.
You know?
I don't know that Harold would.
I don't know.
I mean.
Well, yeah, I guess.
I don't know. You never, I mean, it's hard to say.
It's just such a cool band name.
Vomit Note.
Vomit Note? Is that like the brown note?
Yeah.
That note that you hit and you don't know whether you've been able to hold it in? It's a good one. Anyway, that's why I learned to play bass, by the way, is because you know, the notes, like a really good bass cab when you're playing live and your amp's really good and your bass cab's really good, like you really have to squeeze tight to make sure that you've maintained control because your body is vibrating so much. And that is that's what's so awesome about playing the bass. No one with me on this? Okay. What do you mean? You went to rock concerts all the time. You don't know what I'm talking about?
I only watch the drummer.
By the way, Nastasha, obsessed with There's a Feeling Coming in the Air Tonight by Phil Collins.
No. Everyone, go online, Google the video when he's live, and he sings the entire song walking on stage, and you're worried he's not going to make it to the drum set before that important part, but he does.
I guarantee I'm not worried about it. Finally, we found something that I'm not worried about that you are worried about. Phil Collins making it to the drum set. All right. Josh Krieger writes in on heating elements and cast iron. Nastasia and Dave, two questions for you. What kind of heating element is used in the PolyScience immersion circulators? Are they PTC heaters or something else? Well, for those of you not in the heating know, a PTC heater is a positive temperature coefficient heater. What a positive temperature coefficient heater is it's a heating element. They're usually like chips. They're like, you know, little chips. And they're arrayed. You put a bunch of them in, you heat them. But the hotter they get, the higher their resistance goes. But it's not in a linear fashion. So over a normal kind of heat range where you might want to control a heater, it has a relatively low resistance. And then as soon as it heats up beyond a certain predetermined point that they determine by what they dope it with, I think they're usually made with barium titanate, and they have a little doping crap in them to change the temperature at which the resistance really change, but you hit a certain temperature and all of a sudden, bam, the resistance goes way up, which throttles the power down. So they're called self-limiting because they can't burn themselves out. And that's an advantage. So, by the way, no, PolyScience does not use them. PolyScience uses standard resistance heaters with stainless steel sheaths. So they use a bendable tubular immersion heater with a stainless steel sheath in them. And the way you could tell that they use it, actually, I don't know. I haven't opened up his new one. What's the new one called? The inexpensive one?
I don't remember the name of it.
Sous Vide Creative, yeah. I think. Sous Vide Creative? I haven't opened up the Sous Vide Creative, but none of the older ones use a PTC heater. The advantage of a PTC heater is it doesn't require a secondary safety. So if you look at one of the old PolyScience circulators, or even, I guess, you know, the professional, which is, you know, the one we have, there's a little what looks like a stainless steel sausage strapped to the heating element. And that is a safety thing, such that if the tank runs dry or if anything like that happens and the temperature of the heating element shoots up, then that shuts the system off, right? So... And the advantage, you know, that's standard way of doing it. The advantage of the PTC is it doesn't require that. And also, if it goes over temp, it doesn't actually shut the system down. It just throttles the power down to a point where it's not going to harm anything. So that's the theoretical advantage of them. They're super advantageous in situations where you know that you're not going to be able to stop crud from building up between your heating element and the temperature measurement that's going to use it, right? Because then inefficiencies can mean that your heating element can get so hot that they can burn themselves out. Not really the case in an immersion circulator, but anyway. PTCs have only recently been started to, I think, really being used quite a lot in new applications, so I don't know if Philip will use them eventually, but he's not using them right now as far as I know. Yeah?
Yep.
Caller.
Whoa! Whoa! Wow! Hey. Reverbed caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, listen, Dave, how are you doing?
This
is Matt from a couple times before, but I have a two-part question about kombu today.
Okay.
Is kombu fat soluble, i.e., if I put kombu in oil, will it enhance the flavor of whatever I cook in the oil?
Okay, so we're talking about kombu, which is a seaweed giant kelp that most famously used for making dashi in Japanese cuisine. Also used for curing things like fish, where you wrap, and also as Nils used to do, duck, where he'd wrap the duck in kombu, let it sit, and you develop kind of a cured layer on the outside. Mm-hmm. Okay, so. I mean, obviously, the salty stuff is not really oil soluble, right? But I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the other flavors. We've never done an oil-based kombu. I know that the skin of the duck, which has quite a lot of fat, picked up a lot of really good flavor from the kombu, though. So I know that's the case. But, you know, it's hard for me to say whether or not it's the water part of the skin that's picking up the kombu or whether it was the oil part. It's a really fascinating question. You tend to think mainly about, amino acids, glutamic acids in particular, and other things getting liberated from kombu by the you know, by the cooking process in dashi. And of course, you know, it has all the polysaccharides in it because it's a seaweed, and that's what's providing the structure. But I've never thought about the oil. Please give it a shot and send us a tweet and tell us what happens, because it's,
okay,
you know, it sounds interesting. I'd like to hear what happened.
All right, I'll be honest with you. I'll see where the question comes from. I was watching the recent season of Top Chef, and in one of the episodes, he had a fryer, and he actually had kombu in the fryer. So I've been thinking about it for a couple of weeks now. About, is it fat soluble? Would it really work? I don't know. I haven't tried it, but I did do a lot of research online, so I figured I'd call the person that might have the answer.
Wait, so he was using it not to make a crispy fried kombu, but to flavor the oil?
Yeah.
And on research online, did they say it worked or no?
No, I couldn't find anything that said that kombu was fat soluble or glutaminate. I'm going to say it wrong, but
yeah,
whatever it is,
acid,
the acid or the amino acids were fat soluble. So
yeah, see, here's what I would do. I mean, although, you know, crosses the blood brain barrier, whatever. But like, I always get my brain confused. No, one does, the other one doesn't. No, it doesn't. Yeah, it's not. Anyway, so the what I would do is I would just run a side-by-side test where you, you know, and then serve it to someone to see if they can tell the difference. Even better yet, do a triangle test where you serve them three, two of them are the same and one is different, and have them try and figure out which one's which and why.
Fair enough. That sounds great. I will do.
Cool. So,
The second part of the question is, I just recently read the article that was written by the Food Lab on Sirius Eats about brining chicken and turkey, and talks about how using a protein brine like chicken stock doesn't flavor the meat per se, because the particles in the chicken stock are too big to get into the protein, even though the protein expands.
Right.
My question is, if you were to put kombu in the brine, do you think that the glutaminic acid or the amino acids will get inside of the protein, or is it just for show?
I don't know. I mean, like, a kombu definitely flavors the surface of the meat and causes a curing because it has salt. There are very small water-soluble molecules in kombu that will do some penetration. I don't know. I mean, so, you know, individual amino acids are not large, but I don't know what their diffusion characteristic through the surface of a meat is. Others, you know, be like, because salt is really small. Do you know what I mean?
Right, because the salt gets in, the salt helps open up the protein strands.
Right. Well, it changes, like, it shifts the conformation of the protein, right?
And there you go.
Yeah. I don't know. I just gotta say, I don't. That's another thing. I don't know. My guess is that you're not getting too much effect past the surface unless you inject it.
Okay.
Or if you have, you know, holes in it, you know, but like, this is why you usually, if you're gonna with a broth or something, you inject it in. I mean, salts, small molecules, things diffuse through. But so I guess that means I'm in agreement with the Sirius Eats post then, right?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I'm working with plenty of friends.
Oop! Cutting out.
Not understanding.
Yep.
I said I'm working with an old friend of yours here in Chicago.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, with Musa.
Oh, yeah? How's he doing?
Yep. He's doing great. You're really good.
Nice. All right. Well, say howdy for me. Been a long time.
I will for sure. I will for sure. And he's teaching me a lot of great stuff. I'm learning everything I ever needed to know about hydrocolloids. And and so that's pretty much it. So great radio station or radio show. Thank you very much, and I'll keep listening.
All right. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks. Bye.
Jack putting the reverb even on me, like that?
Yeah, yeah.
On the thing. Thank you. You. All right. So Josh Krieger's second question in was, I have a 14-inch cast iron skillet. I'm thinking about flipping it upside down and using it as a baking steel for pizza. Is there a temperature where the seasoning on the skillet would start to degrade, i.e., can I use it at 550 degrees Fahrenheit without issues? Okay, before I get into that, so the pizza steel is this thing that, you know, the modernist cuisine guys were saying that they use a very thick piece of steel that they heat up, and that delivers a wallop of heat to pizzas. You know, they say in a more effective way than something like a stone would, and is easier to load the heat into than a stone, right? Mm-hmm. Now, my question is, I don't know if a cast iron pan has enough stored energy to do what what Josh wants here. But that's not the question, so I'm not going to get into that question because that wasn't the question. Now, 550 Fahrenheit, you're getting very close. So let's go back to what the cast iron seasoning is. So cast iron seasoning, seasoning a cast iron pan, you're doing a couple of things. And by the way, last night when I saw this question, I went and did a re-research because occasionally people like change their write new things about what's going on. So I was just checking up, and I found actually a really old thread on the Garden Web that written by this kind of like this interesting dude from Louisiana, Dan AB Z9LA for Louisiana on the Garden Web. And not Louisiana, not LA for Los Angeles, LA for Louisiana. Yes. Anyway, and he's like a retired chemist, and he has, strangely, on this Garden Web thing from like 2007, possibly the best explanation of what's going on in a pan curing that I've read. Anyway, so in a pan curing situation, you're taking an oil or a fat, you're putting a thin layer on your pan, and then heating it till it's past the smoke point, it starts to turn black, break down. So he says that there's two things that are going on. One, you're polymerizing the oil, right, by breaking it down at wherever it has like a double bond, breaking it down, and it's forming a polymer. The polymer is hard, right? But also breaking fat down in general into its smaller parts and leaving carbon residues. And I looked it up, and carbon residues of oils is one of the things people measure, especially in the petroleum industry, because they need to know how much soot is going to be left over when oils are burned or when they're degraded, right? So he says you want that carbon because the carbon is adding to the kind of the non-stick principle. So it's a combination of polymerization of oil and the carbon it's put down. But if you heat it too high, you're going to break down those polymers that you put on it. And the problem is that the temperature at which that happens is going to depend partly on what oil was there to begin with, along with a lot of other factors. I will say this. I have burnt the seasoning off of pans in my oven. Now, my oven gets hotter. Remember I told you before, I do pizza in my oven. My oven gets up to like 850, 875 degrees, and it will easily burn the seasoning off of a cast iron pan. The self-cleaning on an oven, which runs a little bit hotter, a little over 900 Fahrenheit, is going to burn the seasoning off of a cast iron pan, just vaporize it. I've had pans on my stove overheat and lost some seasoning on them when I'm going super, super, super high heat on these little cast iron skillets that I have. So, if you were saying 500, I'd say you're okay. If you were saying 650, I'd say not okay. I have a bunch of pan stone bowls that get seasoned with oil. The hot stone bowls for Korean food, and I get them up to about 615, 620 all the time, and that wipes out the seasoning on the bottom. So, it's tough to say. Like, if you can guarantee your 550, you're probably going to be okay, but if you go much higher than that, it's going to be a problem, you know? But check out Dan ABZ9LA on the Garden Web, so you can you check it out. Another interesting thing is that there's another blog out there. I forget. Her name is Cheryl Cantor. I forget the name of her blog, but she has an interesting post on cast iron where she actually, because the whole point of you're familiar with drying oil, like linseed oil for mm-hmm. painting? Yeah. So it's like, she's like, why not, since what you're trying to do is form a polymer, why not use the oil that's actually good at that, even at room temperature, which is flaxseed oil, linseed oil. And so she seasons now all of her pans with flaxseed oil, and she says she gets really good results, because there's a lot of people on the internet that really care about what oil they use. And Dan, I'm going to say it again because I can't. Dan ABZ9LA.
You should do it in the Army code so people know what they're,
What, Alpha, Bravo, Zeta? Yeah. But I don't know whether he was ever in the Army or not. I know he's in Louisiana.
So when people are writing it down, they're not writing down like C instead of Z.
Here's why I've never met this guy, Dan, but here's why I like his posts. Because it's like he just says something, and then like later on you find out that like he has only started dipping his finger in the kind of crap that he knows. Because he's like, I don't know. Because at one point someone asked him a question. He's like, I don't know. I got another good 10, 15 pots I got to season tomorrow, so I'll test. I'm like, Dan, what the hell does this guy do? Like, he's a retired chemist. He's like, well, here's what I do when I'm re-seasoning my 30-gallon cast iron hog cooker. I'm like, what the hell? You know what I mean? So anyway, so my man Dan, whatever it is, Dan ABZ9LA. Anyway, like to meet that guy someday. okay. And Josh thanks us. He says, thanks as always. The show is fantastic. Continues to improve the way I cook and the quality of food I produce, which I appreciate. Justin Thrasher writes in on barrel-aged cocktails in the Cornelius keg. Hey, what time is it, Jack?
46.
Ooh! Let's take one more commercial break. Come back. Cooking issues!
All right.
CEO of the International Culinary Center interviews the top chefs in the world on Chef Story. Hear from chefs like Christina Tosi.
I'm going to be the best pastry cook this restaurant's ever seen.
Francis Malman.
Cooking with fire, it's very feminine, it's very fragile.
And Jacques Pepin.
I was invited to work at the White House for John Kennedy.
Learn how the greats become great every Wednesday at 12 p.m. on Chef Story at heritageradionetwork.org.
It wasn't that John Kennedy. It was actually a different... No, I'm kidding.
It was John Kennedy from Jersey.
Yeah, it was John Kennedy from Jersey. He was working at the White House at the time. No. I love my man Jacques Pepin. He's done some cool... You know, he was like... I think he was Mitterrand's... was it Mitterrand's chef? Was he chef for Mitterrand, I think, for a while? And he's got an amazing story. Read his autobiography. I have. He's one of the reasons that I'm cooking today. In fact,
really?
Oh yeah, hell yeah. Jacques Pepin. Back in the day, I used to watch his show on PBS. And when I was young, one of the early cookbooks I bought was his kind of mid '80s two-part book on cooking. It was all in color. It was like expensive. I got it as a remainder because it was so far ahead of what Americans wanted to see. He teaches you how to skin a baby lamb in this book, and so it's his two part series. I think it's called I forget what it's called. Anyway, but it's not the large black and white one, which is a fantastic bargain. Go, but two part by Knopf color series that Jacques Pepin did. Anyway,
sweet. Well, episode one of Chef Story too. Cool interview with him.
Yeah,
life story. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, good man. Okay, Justin Thrasher writes in. Hey Dave, love the show. Listen weekly, and I'm contemplating trying to get cocktails to force carbonate them later on. Ultimately, I would be able to like to barrel age cocktails in a small 2.5-gallon Cornelius keg. Cornelius kegs are the kegs that were used for soda manufacture back in the day. It's called premix, where you'd mix the soda water and the syrup together in a keg, carbonate the whole thing, and force it out. They look kind of like tall, skinny beer kegs, and the system went out of favor, but homebrewers have been using those kegs for years because they're fantastic for small 5-gallon brew sizes for homebrewers. They also make a smaller 2.5-gallon Cornelius keg. However, they're a lot more expensive than the 5-gallon. That's just for those of you that don't know what a Cornelius keg is. Okay. Ultimately, I would be able to barrel-age cocktails in a small 2.5-gallon Cornelius keg and then later carbonate them to serve. Can you possibly add any of your expertise? Nope. No, I'm just kidding. That's what Stas always wants me to say. Nope.
Yep.
Here's the deal. Barrel aging is there's a couple of things going on. So in barrel aging, it typically means it's in a barrel, meaning there's wood. So if you're going to add chips to this thing because you're going to age, because you have to add chips, you have to pull the chips out before you're going to carbonate. If by aging you just mean letting it mellow, so Tony C, Tony Conigliaro, or Conigliaro, as the baseball fans here in the U.S. say, for many years he's aged cocktails in the bottle, and the aging in the bottle is not the same thing as aging it in a barrel. He's doing it like the small amount, the marrying of the spirits, the reduction of the proof, although he doesn't dilute it beforehand, but the reduction of the proof because of things like added vermouth, plus the little bit of oxygen that's in the bottle, and remixing it causes it to age over time in the bottle. Okay. Now, more recently, people have been barrel aging, and in that case, you have the oxygen effects, the marrying effects, and the effects of wood. But for that, you need wood. But they're two semi-related but different kinds of things. So if you're going to do it in a corny keg, you're going to have to add wood chips because corny kegs are stainless steel. Another thing is you're going to have to, like I say, remove the wood, but also you're not going to want to age something in a Cornelius keg like that at when it's diluted. So you're going to have to do it full strength, and then you have to dilute it before you carbonate it. You have to dilute it before you carbonate it. Another thing about carbonating in a Cornelius keg and forcing it out with forced carbonation is you're going to need to get that sucker cold. I like things that are very bubbly. If you want a very light bubble in it, then you don't need to get it as cold. Then ice water cold is good enough. But for the stuff that we carbonate at the bar, we're carbonating down at like 22, 23 Fahrenheit, like minus, what is that, 8? 9, 10 Celsius. Also, you're going to need to buy a cold plate because in order to get something out of the keg, cocktails foam a lot. You need to mellow it out. To mellow it out, you're going to need to put the cocktail through a cold plate to allow it to go along a bunch of smooth tubing beforehand. And you're going to need to get what's called a Becker squeeze valve, B-E-C-K-E-R squeeze valve. You can get it from Mark Powers in Guntersville, Alabama. They have it, and those valves have a compensator in the back and allow you to do it. And that's the only way. Everyone I know does it, uses those valves. I've used those valves for many, many, many years, and the valve is going to make a big difference. You're also still going to get a lot of foaming. You're just going to get a lot of foaming, right? I mean, it's just going to happen. Okay, Matt Wilson writes in. I'm looking to buy a centrifuge. I'm searching eBay. I found a Hermley ZK380. And he gives a link. Is this a good candidate for home use? I'm close by and can go pick it up. It doesn't come with a rotor, and I'm not sure how much of an issue that is. Matt Wilson. Matt, that is a huge issue. I would not, even though it's only like $150, I mean, unless you know you can buy a rotor from someone, I mean, without the rotor, the centrifuge might as well just be a big doorstop. You know what I mean? So unless you know you can get the rotor and the buckets for that sucker, I would stay away from it. If you can get the buckets and rotor, look, let's say you can buy another one. The centrifuge looks fine for specs. I mean, it's got a little small. It doesn't have that large of buckets. I think it does 1 liter at a time. But let's say you found another ZK. This is what I would do. Let's say you found another ZK380 on the internet, and it has a good rotor, but maybe it's a little beat up and you're worried about the brushes not being good or whatever. Buy this sucker for spare parts. For $150 as a spare parts machine, if you already have a good rotor and buckets, that's a good deal. But trying to find rotors and buckets is like needles in haystacks. And buying them new, this is a very old machine. I looked at the manual online, is old. Like, I would stay away from it. I would always go try to get one that had a good working rotor and buckets. And the rotors and buckets have to be good, not dinged, not like viciously old, not mutilated. And you're still taking a risk by using a used rotor because you don't know what the other person did. You don't know whether they used the bucket to, I don't know, like pry their car door open. You don't know what the hell they used it for. You know what I mean? Yeah. Okay. Joseph W. writes in, at Cooking Issues, I work at a restaurant in Atlanta. We have a PacoJet. What are some good PacoJet uses other than ice cream and sorbet? Thanks. That's mainly what we used it for when I used to have access to one at the French Culinary. We almost always made ice cream with it because it was so good at it. There's a new set of blades you can buy called the Coupe Set that allows you to do a lot of work with it without freezing first. So you can do farces, like mousses and meat farces and grinding things with a PacoJet without first freezing everything. Because one of the downsides of everything is that you have to freeze everything. So it comes with a whipping disc, although I don't know why you'd want to whip cream in a PacoJet because it makes no sense. But what it does do is the whipping disc, you can throw fresh fruit in with the cream and the sugar, and it'll whip the fruit directly into the cream without having to do a puree or something like that. So I guess that's theoretically an advantage. But typically what you would do on the savory side is, like, let's say you wanted to store a bunch of stuff like herb, and you wanted to put like a concentrate or an herb or a puree of that herb into something like a soup. In a PacoJet, what's awesome is you pack it into a PacoJet container and you just use the portion that you want. You do it and then you stir. It's frozen, so it stays good forever, frozen solid like a block. And then you just you spin in the PacoJet whatever part you need, and you add that part to whatever you're working on, soup, sauces, and it melts right in, right? Certain other things when you're doing farces or mousses, rather, if they have enough structure, you can freeze them and then scoop them if they have enough structure to hold after they thaw out and serve them as is or if they're cold. But a lot of things, what they're doing is when they're making mousses with a PacoJet, they're using the PacoJet to make a very, very fine texture. Because you got to remember, PacoJet, the texture on a PacoJet is smaller than the texture you can get out of a VitaPrep. The texture out of a VitaPrep is not quite smooth enough for your tongue to not register it. The particles are over 20 micrometers in size, whereas just slightly, I think, at maximum efficiency for a VitaPrep. Whereas in a PacoJet, you're getting ice crystals that are crystals, shavings that are small enough for your tongue not to register them as individual grains, i.e. smaller than 20 micrometers, you know, more on the order of ice cream crystals. And so you can make purees of things that are extremely smooth by freezing them, spinning them in the PacoJet, and then using that puree, thawing it, and then when they're making a mousse, they don't make the mousse directly in the PacoJet. What they typically do is they'll freeze it like whatever. Like on PacoJet's website, they use broccoli. I don't know why they do that, but whatever. And then they cook the broccoli, they put it in the PacoJet, they freeze it solid, they spin it down, and then they make a mousse out of that with whipped cream and gelatin like a standard mousse. But I don't know. Does that help at all?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And last, on the way out, because I have, it looks like 4 minutes, there's a, I don't know, in I've been at, you know how the people reference you? Well, you don't know because you hate social media, but they reference you in a Twitter thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I've been referencing this in this line of stuff about Cooks Illustrated and pressure cookers.
You're going on their radio show on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, so they rated pressure cookers, and they didn't rate the Kuhn Recon one, which I like a lot, so highly, and they rated the Fagor one, highly. It's like one of their favorites, and there's all this like twittering around on like, well, what's good and what's bad and what's not. Here's my two cents because we talked about pressure cookers recently. Go read Cooks Illustrated now has their ratings online, and this is one of those situations where I think their ratings are pretty off based. You know, go look at Hit Pressure Cooker. You know, the blog. Go look at Miss Vicky's pressure cooker. But the people at Cooks Illustrated dinged the Kuhn Recon one because they said that it was hard for them to adjust the temperature on it. Whereas for me, it's like Kuhn Recon, and they also they said for anybody that read the Cooks Illustrated what's it called reviews on this, they said that the Kuhn Recon evaporated the most water of all like many of the pressure cookers they took. It is exactly the opposite of the truth. The reason I like Kuhn Recon is twofold. One, it's extremely easy at all times to see exactly what the pressure is inside of the Kuhn Recon because there's a spring that indicates exactly what the pressure is inside of the Kuhn Recon thing. The reason I don't like the Fagor model is because it does not indicate its pressure unless it's venting out material. And people get this confused all the time. Here's what's going on. In a pressure cooker, there are two things happening in something like a Fagor pressure cooker. There's an indicator that the unit is under pressure at all, and that's a little yellow dot that pops up. As soon as that little yellow dot pops up, you know that the unit is under some amount of pressure. However, you don't know what that pressure is. You just know it's under some amount of pressure, right? Then you keep the thing going and you don't know what's going on because nothing happens until steam starts coming out of the vent, right? So the Fagor one is a venting pressure cooker, which I don't like. I don't like it because it affects the flavor of things like stocks. At least it has in the tests that I've run with it. Now, the only way to keep it at pressure then is to make sure that you're keeping that little steam going all the time, which I don't like. I've never liked it. Another thing I don't like is because there's always steam going through that valve when you're working it, that and the valve is a mechanism that turns, that valve gets clogged very easily and gets burnt out very easily. Of the 5 Fagor pressure cookers that we had at the French Culinary Institute for the 5 years that I was working with Fagor pressure cookers there, we burnt out every one that we had. The mechanisms got burnt out because they got clogged and they wouldn't hold anymore because they're hard to clean for the students that are working with them, or they would melt out because someone had flames licking over the side and the pressure mechanism, which is very close to the side of the pan in the Fagor, would get ruined, right? That's never happened to me in a Kuhn Recon. I've had the handles broken off of my Kuhn Recon. I've had the little plate on the top, the diverter plate, get ripped off and thrown away, but the sucker still holds pressure and doesn't clog, and the valve is extremely easy to clean. Also, Kuhn Recon doesn't need to vent at all. If you're venting in a Kuhn Recon, it means you put it over pressure and the safety is released where the spring goes up and release steam out of the same spring valve. So, you know, both those criticisms of the Kuhn Recon. The Kuhn Recon is also fairly easy for me to adjust. So go online, look it up. Kuhn Recon, still my favorite pressure cooker. Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.